Hey guys, my name is Sabir Bharti and a very warm welcome to the Sabir Bharti Show, the place where I interview interesting people with interesting perspectives. And today's guest is actually a returning guest. He was on this very show about 4 years ago. He's a very dear friend of mine, and it's been wonderful and inspiring to see his development over the last few years. And that's what we're going to be delving into over the next hour or so. His name is Dr. Jolo Mia, also known as Dr. Jolo, across his social media platforms. You can catch him on Instagram and Twitter using his handle at Dr. Jolo. He's also got a fabulous website, so please do go check him out there using his website, which is drjolo.com. That's spelled drjolel.com. You can also follow his work on his YouTube channel. He often creates very interesting videos on YouTube, and his videos are all about helping you make psychology more accessible. And he does this by delving into the nuances of this discipline. Before we jump into the chat, I'm just going to give you some more information about Dr. Jolo. So he is a lecturer of psychology at the University of Sunderland in the United Kingdom. He's obtained a master's in health psychology, as well as a PhD in applied psychology. He is a fellow of the Higher Education Academy and also a chartered psychologist as recognized by the British Psychological Society. But that's not all. He is also a founder of mental health charity Our Minds Matter and was also named winner of the competition I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here. As I did mention earlier, he does share his thoughts on psychology through his YouTube channel. And the best way to search for his videos on there is simply typing in Dr. Jolo on YouTube, and all of his latest videos will pop straight up. So let's get straight into the show and welcome our guest. A very warm welcome to Dr. Jolo. Hello.
That was a great introduction.
I'll be honest, I was truly inspired even by reading that that introduction, and you know, it's because we've been friends for quite a while, so it's been great for me to see your progress over the last few years. And firstly, I just wanted to give my personal congratulations again to you for achieving your PhD, and that's where I wanted to start. So if you wouldn't mind, share with us what the experience was like going through the PhD, because I know it took a number of years. How was the experience, and how do you feel now that it's all over?
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, absolutely. I mean, hopefully, you know, we've been friends longer than a few years. So, you know, it's been a pleasant experience, you know, overall. But it didn't come without challenges, I should say. I think the last time we spoke, you know, on this podcast, a few years ago, I think it was about 3 years ago. 3 years ago? Yeah, it was about 3 years ago, I think. And at the time, I was just in the process of now kind of like finalizing or going towards the write-up stage. And that's something that I was prepared for, anticipated that, you know, it's gonna take me a lot of energy, emotional effort to complete, to see it to the end. But I didn't know what it would have taken, what it took by the time I'd completed it. And I was completely drained by it all. So the PhD along the years, first of all, it's very exciting. You're starting a new path. You're unsure what's going to happen. You don't know how you're going to collect the data, how you're going to analyze the data. You don't know if this is the right thing. You don't know if this is the right path for you. So lots of anxieties, a lot of doubts were happening. But you know, there comes a midpoint, you know, check when you start to notice that you go from like being a beginner, like in your research field, to an expert. And that transition happens because people, first of all, you're asking other people when you first start off about what you should do, how you should design the research, you know, what methods you should pick, and, you know, what technique to analyze the information. How do you analyze it? Where would we use it? Then you start making that transition of like informing people of what the methodology should be used, how you should analyze the data. you start to become the person who's trying to communicate that information. So overall, the experience was not just, I don't know, a learning, you know, a learning moment, but it also developed your, the way you see the world, because the PhD overall pushed you. I mean, yeah, I don't know if you got another question on it, but it's something that I'm still trying to process, if I'm still honest with you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually had a look at your website recently, and one of your blog articles on your website mentioned the PhD, and the title actually caught my attention because you mentioned in there something about how many days it took for your PhD to be completed. And I believe the number was 2,830 days. And I put that into the calculator and it came out as just over 7 years. Now, from your experience, is that amount of time normal for a PhD? If not, what was it like being in that process for 7 years? Because it can be quite, of course, a long period. I imagine lots of ups and downs. How did you manage to negotiate that length of time when trying to complete it?
It was, you know, one heck of a long time. I look back on it and thinking, is that how many days I spent on it? Because it's not, the PhD is not 9 to 5. Absolutely not. This is, I mean, it's not 9 to 5 Monday to Friday. It's not a thing. It's with you every single, you know, day. Every single hour. Yeah, there might be moments where you switch off, but I'm speaking to lots of PhD students, right? No one's ever switched off. It doesn't switch off. It's always there at the back of the front, in the middle, on the side of your mind, you know, wherever you're thinking about, it's always there. And they say, you know, there's this terminology called PhD called permanent head damage, right? Which means when it's been there for so long, it leaves a stain, it leaves a mark. And that's what they call permanent head damage. So there's that concept. What was it like? So yeah, it's 7 years. The average is about 8 years. That's the longest, but most people complete within 4 years, depending on their situation, funding and stuff. Part-time, you're looking at about 8 years. But when I think about, that's official registration, 7 years. So when you register at university, you put your name on the form, they approve your program to the point of like you've left the program, that was 7 years. But actually in terms of like the PhD, it takes a bit more longer. I think it wasn't 7 years because the planning took about an extra year to get into the PhD. So there's an extra year added on, but I didn't put that in part of the official registration. So registration, I was registered for that many days on the PhD. But so actually it took about a year before. So it's 8 years there altogether. And then if you think about when I finished last year with a certificate, I'm still basically trying to publish from the research. So it's still going on. So it's not like the start and finish point, which when we go to education, we think, okay, we're going to go from this building and exit from another building in this many years. You know, that's not what PhD is. And a lot of people think there's a big misconception about PhD is that it's all about, you know, start and finish, because that's how we map the world out. So when you're doing sprints, we think 100 meter race, we're thinking, you know, starting point 0 meters to 100 meters and that's it. But that's how we start to vision life. And then people adapt this concept of thinking into the PhD world. We're thinking, hang on. And that's where most people get it wrong, because they're like using a formula from one situation to apply everything else. And in the PhD was a big part of like unraveling all of that. Actually, it's not the same. So all PhDs would be different, the topics, the designs. But in terms of like what was the most interesting thing that I learned, a lot of people left the PhD while I was there. So they finished, so they didn't complete the program. This was my peers. Because you know, when you do it for that long, right? You meet so many people, and then you meet, I met people who are just finishing. I've met people who are started before me, but finished before me. And I met people, like I said, people who left. So I basically got a very rich experience by communicating, connecting with other PhD students. and they're telling me about what's it done to them. And sometimes it's not always been pleasant for them, you know, and that's the truth. Like, yeah, you can't deny the truth.
Yeah, no, completely. And I mean, I can imagine, well, I can't actually imagine because I've never done a PhD, but because we've been friends for a long time, I've often heard updates from yourself every time we've spoken and had a catch up. So I guess I know a little bit about what you went through, and just hearing you elaborate on it now, it's really inspiring because, you know, it takes a lot of effort for something like this. And I certainly wasn't that way inclined through my years in education. So I really appreciate it and actually respect people who can dedicate themselves to such a thing like a PhD. So like from the bottom of my heart, like, congratulations again, that you should be so proud of yourself and the achievements that you've had up to date. Now, I just want to switch gears slightly. Because I know you've had a lot of big changes in your life recently, changes which you've made deliberately for your own progression. And one of the big standout moments for you was, of course, your position at the University of Sunderland. You're now a lecturer there, a lecturer in psychology. So with your permission, I'd love to perhaps talk about that for a few minutes. What was it like, firstly, taking on this role, and what has this role done for you so far?
I think it's a great question. I think I look back and what I'd done before, when I left school, I didn't do what everyone else did. I didn't go to college, for example. I went into work. I did an apprenticeship. Apprenticeship was very rarely heard in our school. No one hardly ever done an apprenticeship, and complete apprenticeship, not just do one, right? Start one, complete one. So that was a big change back then when I was, you know, young. And then I think about leaving the workplace, right? Completely changing industry, you know, altogether, and going in a completely different direction into psychology, you know, going to university. Massive changes. So coming to, and I think when I reflect on the Sunderland move, you know, coming from the south to the north, I can make the comparisons. Actually, that's always been there, like in terms of like, or even starting the charity, you know, with others. I'm very happy to be put at my comfort zone. If the situation has forced me, right, because things are not working out, things are not happening the way I want it to happen, and if someone provides an opportunity and if there's a door opening somewhere, I think it's like it's on me to take a chance at least. And so this opportunity came up, and you know, the team basically, the management team were very intrigued and very encouraging and very welcoming, not just of like my, you know, my presence, but my ideas, my ways of thinking. And I never really got that from other places. So I just felt basically this is a natural fit between me and the organization and where the university was fitting with its, you know, values and its vision for its students, and for the overall organization. And I just thought my values and my principles align well with this university and I can work with them. So it was a natural fit. And I think that's the word they used. That's the, and that made me feel more stimulated, more motivated. I think that's important in the workplace, to respect your employees who are part of your team. Like, we're all equals, we're all colleagues. And one thing they said, we have flatline structures. So there's no hierarchy as such. Like, you know, it's not about who owns who. We all flatline, we all work together. And I liked that culture. And I thought I wanted to be part of that culture and contribute to that culture. So making that change became easy because of the conditions that were set. You know, first from previous experience, I think I've always had it in me to basically, you know, dare out of my, you know, comfort zone, to not to be the norm. I don't think anyone that I know in my circle studied psychology or even the health sciences. So, you know, I've always believed in you know, individual choices and choosing your own path. So coming to Sunderland wasn't, I don't think it was just like, you know, a big shock. Actually, I've always done that, I think. It's just like me telling myself, oh yeah, by the way, you've always done this anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, no, completely makes sense. And thank you for sharing that. Now, another thing that you've been heavily involved in recently over the last few years, and I mentioned it in the introduction, is your activity on social media. You seem to be going from strength to strength with your social media posts on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and also you have a fabulous podcast as well called Psychology Cast. So let's start with the podcast, because I know you've been doing that for quite a while now, and you've interviewed a number of people, and very interesting conversation you've been having on that podcast. So let's start with that. Why did you want to start a psychology podcast? How did you find the process of starting it, finding guests, and also perhaps tell us a little bit about your experience of speaking to all these guests? What has it done for you? Because I imagine it's quite an exciting process to be a host of a podcast like yours.
You know, well, first of all, I should say thank you very much to yourself and, you know, what you did before when we started the podcast. So when you started the podcast, but when we had the conversation, but yeah, it's not 3 years ago, it's 4 years ago. And I'm thinking back, because I started mine 3 years ago. So it had been 4 years ago, we had that conversation. You brought me in to be a guest. And that's what inspired me to start this work. And I know that the whole social media thing was not something that I was a fan of when I first started off. But when I saw you doing it, in terms of the podcast, and you started talking about these concepts about presenting yourself on video, and I just thought to myself, like, yeah, that don't sound like me. Actually, it sounds quite, you know, quite cringing when I was watching your stuff. I'm like, that looks a bit awkward. You know, I can't do that. You know, what does he think he's doing? You know, like, is he feeling all right? But I think I was more intrigued. I'm like, okay, because I believe in experimentation, right? I think you should experiment. And I was thinking, okay, I think naturally, because maybe the field that I'm in social scientists and being a scientist, I'm curious into cause and effect. So I thought, okay, let me watch this experiment a few more times. And then I thought, okay, well, the only way to learn and the way to find out is by participating and creating something. So I started to do a bit more, and then I started getting feedback and people said it was helpful. And I thought to myself, really? Because I was doing a lot of educational stuff anyway through the charity, you know, running workshops, seminars, conferences, you know, being out there in the public, handing out leaflets. So why is that any different? You know, and I thought to myself, well, can I apply my time and make it more efficient? Because I haven't got time to talk to everyone. The PhD was getting busy. So I found social media for me the way to communicate with the people who've already been, you know, have been exposed to my content in terms of like the training courses I used to run about mental health. If I put in this platform, at least in that way, I don't lose them, and then they're still getting that value. And but it's listening to the feedback that was important. So I'm still not this thing where I want to be, but I'm happy just communicating information. But the podcast, I think inviting people. So I saw how you did it, basically, and I watched a few others. Okay, you know, what is it about the podcast? I really thought about my idea, what it is that I'm trying to have the conversation about, and the tagline is why we do what we do. So it's all about the motivation behind someone. What the hell is causing all of this to for them to do what they do? I'm very interested in that. So I lined it with my own interests. I'm like, if I can understand what motivates other people, I understand more about what I think about myself. So it's like having mirrors, right? And the guests are mirrors, basically. I think like what I've witnessed. They're showing me who I am. They're sharing their story. And I think the guests, so the listeners, and I think there's a range of listeners now. And obviously the psychology department are very interested in podcasts, and they promote it to their students and they share it around. Actually, they bring you up before I bring you up and they introduce me. That's quite interesting, because I feel quite still like that imposter syndrome thing, right? I think to myself, like, oh, it's not that good. It's okay, you know. I think the guests are great, but, you know, I don't think as a host I'm okay. But and the overall production's okay, but they seem to take more benefit than I do sometimes. And that makes me think, okay, I've done a positive contribution. Because the reason why I want to put that out there with, you know, with some interesting guests is because, you know, lots of people are exposed to lots of noise, right? And I wanted to provide value. I didn't want to add noise. So you will rarely see me doing a rant on social media, because I think there is a time and space for people to do that. I respect people who do that, of course. That's not what I do. I chose to basically say, okay, I want to provide value. How do I provide value? By many different forms. So it's not just my voice they should be interested in. They should be listening to this person. And the students that I teach right now, right, in university, or they always come up to me after the lecture or after a seminar, you know, and one student or two students said, oh, I listened to your podcast with that person, by the way, and because they were on a similar journey. So I'm glad that, you know, it's acting as a resource for them, because, you know, it can be an isolating experience, whatever the people are going through. So if this can provide some sort of aid to help them understand about their journey and by communicating someone else's journey, they don't necessarily have to listen to my own, because I can't relate to everybody. But if I can meet other people, like, you can relate to them, like, don't worry about me. But look at these people are equally going on that, you know, journey themselves, and you can do as well. So the podcast has provided so many different perspectives, but it's made me self-aware about, I think the one I struggle with is about achievements though. You know, so when you said, you know, saying all those things, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. For me, it's literally, it doesn't feel I haven't done anything. I should be doing more. You know, I haven't done enough. That's how I feel. I think to myself, yeah, it's just work. They're nothing really. Anyone can do it. But it's recognized. I think, so I do ask the guests that question, you know, how do you manage the self-care? How do you motivate yourself or recognize what you've done? How do you unwind? So I think there's that element to the podcast about, it's not just helping me, but it's also helping the audience who might be going through a similar journey as me, trying to find out what it is, what they do.
Yeah. No, really, you are doing such a fabulous job with that podcast. I think you're an amazing host. Your style, your delivery, the way you make your guests feel comfortable, because it's not easy, right? When you have a guest, to make them feel comfortable, to allow them to open up about the subject that you've brought them on to talk about. And, you know, you do a fabulous job at that. And even if you won't say it yourself, because I know you for a long time, and I know you're a very humble, modest guy. So I'll say it for you. You are, like, truly doing an amazing job. And it's funny what you said earlier, that coming onto this show 4 years ago inspired you to start your own. And it's funny how it's come around in full circle this time, because watching you be so consistent with your positive work on social media, your podcast, actually inspired me to relaunch this show, because I haven't done this show for just over a year, and honestly, you being so consistent has actually inspired me to start my own stuff again. So I just wanted to take this opportunity as well just to say thank you for inspiring me. And yeah, just keep up the great work. You're doing a great job with the podcast. Now, let's also touch on the Instagram and Twitter and YouTube, because I know you are also posting regularly on YouTube. You help people with the subject of psychology, making it more accessible through YouTube videos, also Instagram and Twitter. What difference do you find in terms of creating content for your podcast compared to your other social platforms? Have you found any challenges? If so, what are they? And what do you think about the comparison between the two?
I think the first, yeah, no, first of all, you know, I think you're right, absolutely. You know, I go back to the point of, you know, if you didn't do what you did, I don't think I'd be doing what I'm doing. So I think the inspiration is in a cycle. And I think I've learned that about others. And maybe that's the reason why I invite guests along. I'm like, they can inspire me too. Like, Jamin. So I think it's helped me build that that framework or that strategy around the podcast, which gives it really lots of good value. But to answer that question around what's the difference between YouTube and the podcast, is that what you want?
Yeah, to meaning because of course they're all kind of forms of social media, but I guess the kind of material that you're producing for both are quite different. So how you found, well, I guess a better way of putting it is, how have you found kind of balancing all of these things that you're juggling all at one time? You've got your podcast going, you've got your Instagram, your YouTube videos, you're posting on Twitter. How do you manage the process of juggling all of these platforms in one go?
I'm still learning, I think, if I'm honest. I think I'm trying to find the best, you know, routine, if that's the word to use, of how to do it, or a technique to do it. Everyone has their own way of doing it. So by researching and by looking at others, how they do it and how what they talk about it, sometimes you have to listen to other people doing it such a long time to see how they're managing it. It's all about learning. So learning is a big part of that. Listening from other people's ideas, and you know, listen to their suggestions, but also trial and error. Like sometimes if I don't think it's working, I will abandon. It doesn't mean I abandon the whole thing. I'll say, okay, that method. So it's a bit like thinking like a scientist again, I suppose, or an experimenter. If that methodology isn't working, okay, we have to try a different methodology and keep trying the different methodology till you get the result, you know, or produces some sort of like consistency. So I noticed that, okay, each platform has its own strength. And in thinking, okay, Twitter is mainly for academic stuff, you know, in terms of like communicating ideas and connecting with the fellow peers and academics. LinkedIn is all about perhaps similar, but also about professionalism, like what I'm doing professionally. So if I become this, then I'll post there so people get more information. And then people might spot opportunities. Instagram, in terms of like people want, it's very like, you know, visual, right? So they want quick information, helpful information. YouTube, if they're a bit more committed, I think they're coming there for more information. So the audience sizes, if you like, are on different levels. So from LinkedIn to Twitter to Instagram to TikTok to obviously Facebook to YouTube. And I think each one has its own value. So, you know, there's lots of things, oh yeah, but you haven't got this many people and that many people. I stopped listening to that for a very long time ago. Because it's all about making a contribution to someone. If they're in the room with you, 10 people in the room, then that's all that matters. And that's how I see it now. So the YouTube content is very much, I feel like they're with me in the room. Like there's probably about, I've got 23 subscribers or something, but most people who watch YouTube are not subscribed anyway. So it's not really a fair, you know, representation of the people watching. But I feel like, okay, if 50 people have watched it, I imagine 50 people in a room, that's a lot of people. 10 people is quite a lot of people. 5 people is a good people. 2 people is a lot of people. So I just think to myself, okay, if I'm providing the like honesty, integrity, and giving them something that's making them feel informed, feel empowered, feel as if like they've gained something by watching this. That's the main aim. And same with all the other platforms. Like sometimes you don't have to get the retweets and the likes and all of this stuff just as a measure. People are watching it. So I might have 5,000 followers on, you know, LinkedIn, whatever, 1,000 on Twitter, I think, 1,000 almost on Instagram. So I just think to myself, just don't have to all engage to get value. You know, they're getting it. They're getting it in that sense. And that, you know, it's interesting when people send me their feedback through the DMs. You know, oh, I love your videos. I love what I never hear from them, like in terms of like comments. But sometimes they send me a message. I said, oh, really? I didn't realize it's making, you know, that much of an effect. I'm happy for feedback. Is there anything I can improve on? That's the key thing that I always ask for. Like, can I make it better? Can I make it better? What would you like? And it's all of this kind of like educators are trying to like, you know, trying to say, it's not about what you know. Even when we're giving assessment feedback in university courses and exams and, you know, report writing and essays, we're saying, this is what you're good at. this is what you can improve on. You know, we're not interested in, we always tell them we're not, the grade is irrelevant. Right, it's the feedback that's the most important thing. Because the grade's not going to help you. Where are you going to give yourself a round of applause? Who cares about that, right? You want to think, okay, well, how can I use this to make it a better experience for me and for them? So these platforms, how do you manage it? I have a schedule for like YouTube. My goal is at the moment is probably do one video a week. I'm sticking to that. I made a goal at the end of December. I'm thinking, you know what, next year I'm going to try to put one video out a week. Okay, roughly about 10 minutes. Okay, but if it's 5 minutes, it's okay. It doesn't have to be 10 minutes. Sometimes, I think my shortest one was 4 minutes or 3 minutes. I still put one out a week. I don't care who watches it, but I will speak the truth. I will provide value. That's all I care about. I don't care who watches it. One person gets the truth. That's the most important thing. Like, for me, that's important. So it makes me feel good. And I'm building the library for the future, you know, because I haven't got time to explain everything to lots of people all the time. So these videos will become different, you know, concepts. So that's YouTube. Twitter is basically in terms of like as and when. If anyone's tagging me, if I'm an event, so I use it for that platform. Instagram, I try to do. Instagram, they say, right, sometimes they should post 5 times a week. But I realized that I've listened to other people who are blogging about this. They said it doesn't really matter. They blow up once or once every 2 weeks. But people come back for that information because it's quality information. And people don't want it to be spammed. So I'm very mindful of the audience. And I don't want to, like, you know, take up their time too much. You know, so I'm thinking like to do less and less, but get more engagement that way. Like trust your content, trust your message. And LinkedIn, again, is the same. Facebook, I don't really use Facebook as much, but Facebook and Instagram talk to each other, so people are still following it. So I think there is no, you know, official schedule, but more of a strategy for now. And I might change that strategy, you know, in 6 months or another few months if it's not working. And it's, I think for me to get to where I got to here, but posting regularly, consistently, is about not being concerned with perfectionism. You know, because I think we want to get everything right. It has to be in a certain way, but don't worry. People are not watching your stuff, man. You know, they don't really care. The ones who do care, they come back and they will give you time and patience. And that's the that's the kind of person is my audience. I'm like, yeah, I need that person to be patient. Because this is life I'm communicating, you know. So this isn't just the, this isn't ordering food and say, here you go. Here's your cheeseburger, that's it. This is lifelong. You're going to be keep having that cheeseburger for the rest of your life, I'm giving you. So if you can't be patient, that's on you, not on me.
Yeah. No, it's really inspiring to see not just your content, but also the thought process of how you actually go about creating your content. And it seems as if you are a real strategizer when it comes to things like this. You like to plan things out. It's not just kind of off the cuff. You think hard about your message. And I think that's really key and important, especially when you're trying to share a message that's so important to you. Because I know you love the subject of psychology, and the fact that you're sharing your personal thoughts on the subject with others. And as I said, the way you're doing it is really, really inspiring. Now, before we move on, just a quick reminder again, because we've been speaking quite a bit over the last few minutes about your social media experience. Just a quick reminder, guys, of how you can follow Dr. Jollo. So a reminder for Instagram and Twitter, it's at Dr. Jollo. That's at DrJollel. His YouTube as well, which we just discussed, or he discussed. If you type into YouTube Dr. Jollo, you'll come across all his videos. And at the beginning, we spoke about his podcast as well, which is, of course, Psychology Cast. Just a reminder of that website again, which is drjollo.com. Now, I want to move on to something slightly different. And you actually teed me up very nicely for this next question, because you said when you're deciding how to attack your social media posts, you're doing it like a scientist. And my next question was all about the competition, I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here, which you were actually the winner of. So congratulations for that. Now, as far as I'm aware, I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here was a competition where you had to communicate psychology to students. So could you give us more information about what that initiative was, how you got involved, why you got involved, and how you feel about being the winner?
Yeah, I've most of it. I think when I think about that, it's a positive. It brings a positive memory, a happy memory. I always smile when I think about I'm a Science, Get Me Out of Here. But it is essentially exactly what you said. So it's for young people, ages between, I think they were between 11 to 16, who are thinking about how different types of scientists work in the future. And what they do, they basically try to get an understanding in the day and the life, day in the week of different types of scientists. Okay, and psychologists was one of them. So this was sponsored by the British Psychologist Society. And the award, the competition was in 2019, and it was soon after my PhD. And I thought to myself, I'm finishing my PhD. When I mean finishing the PhD, I was not finishing. I handed in my PhD before I had to wait for my exam. So I thought this is a good way because I won't be writing anymore. And that competition week was like just a month after my PhD hand-in time. So it was like perfect time to enter the competition. It was running by the BPS, which is the British Psychology Society. So looking for people in the field who want to take part. And I just thought it'd be quite fun, like communicating, applying what I do. And I think young people should be considering their careers in psychology. I think it's helped me quite a bit. And I think it's what you said earlier about, you know, I love the discipline because, and explain the discipline because I think it can make a big difference in people's lives. We should all have an aspect of psychology. If we understand about the way we think as we do, become more self-aware, for example, then I think, you know, we will have a better society, a much more effective society. And I think that is a civilized thing to do. Civilization happens when we become self-aware. We become uncivilized when we don't think about others and we don't think about what we're doing. I think psychology provides an introspection to that. And I think it should be the responsibility of everyone to have a look at their own conduct, own behavior. And it's communicated through many, you know, theatrical aspects or theologians, right? Comes in different forms. So I think it's always been there, but it's like, how do you then do the psychology, which is important for me, applying psychology. So the competition was explaining to students, right? And it was quite fun because I was working in prison at the time. It's part of what I was doing. And, you know, they were fascinated to know exactly, you know, what the conversation, what was happening with the prisoners. And, you know, you have to protect the prisoners in terms of like, their details. So you that's communicating professional standards, ethical standards too, ethical behavior. You can't be just like mocking these guys because they're human beings. And that's teaching that to the students and say, look, I know they're prisoners. And, you know, they, you know, you might find that funny what they're doing, but remember they're human beings. And it's like, how do we help them? Not how do we mock them? What type of human do you want to be? That's the type of psychologist that we are trying to implement by following. That's why we have professional guidance. So it's communicating all these aspects. So it's not just about, oh, what's happening in their mind, but actually it's about how do we go about treating others professionally. But the competition ran and they had to vote for their favorite scientists. I was quite shocked that they voted me. It came out for the round at the end, and I was waiting. They said, okay, it would be interesting. What they did, right? So they vote out. It's like, I don't know if you hit me, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. It's this concept that happens in the UK. It's very similar. Every week, their favorite, they vote out a scientist every day. So I thought I'd be voted out on the first day. There's about five or six of us or seven of us or something. And I was like, what? I went to the final and came on Thursday, came on Friday. They said, no, you made it in the top two. I was like, what? Why are they interested in me? I got nothing interesting to say. Okay. And then late in the afternoon, they announced the winner. They voted the other one out and they voted me the winner. And so that was quite a big surprise. Again, maybe it's that thing, you know, find it difficult to accept, you know, achievements and stuff. Maybe because people haven't, you know, from a young age to have done that, well done and stuff. And, you know, so when you say well done, It's quite rare. I get the odd friend telling me well done, but not in a what's the word, in a passive way. You know, there's a difference between passive, like, oh, well done, by the way, and that's it, move on. So you never recognize it of your own achievements. But I think to say well done to someone and to be active rather than be passive is a big thing. Because I think when we're passive, that's why the person, like, that's the reason why I think I can't appreciate, because I've never been, it's always been passive. So when people say well done, it could be my colleagues, whatever, and they're genuine about it, I don't pick it up. I brush it aside, and they've, you know, they've brought that up to me in a very, I think, in a very kind way. They said, you need to appreciate what you've done. And that's quite interesting from a psychologist's point of view. So I have psychologists trying to help me to appreciate your own achievements. I'm like, yeah, but it's not a big thing. They said, no, it is a big thing. You know, I'm like, is it really? And they said, okay, yeah, it is. So I think, you know, so I appreciate what you're saying. And maybe I appreciate all the time when people do say thank you on a deep level, because I'm still, my brain doesn't recognize with everything. So there's still limitations to me. I'm not saying the finished product, what I'm saying, but I think I'm a scientist, get me out of here, winner, reminded me of that. Yeah. But it went to the whole experience. So that was the end of 2019. It's about 3 years ago now.
Yeah. It's interesting what you just said.
I should point out, one of the things they gave me, right?
Yeah.
Continue, was this.
Oh, very nice.
I don't know if you can see that. I thought
that's like a celebratory mug. Is that for winning the competition?
No, this is basically for all every participant. But they did give a prize for a competition. Gave me some money to do some. Guess what? They gave me money to do more educational videos.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting.
That was, they said, yeah, because it was all about communication. So I said, okay, I'll do a vlog, and I gave them a few vlogs. For them to watch, like day in the life, and it was a proper recorded one. And so the students get more experience. And it was like I said, if we didn't have the conversation, if I didn't watch your stuff, I don't think I would have done what I did, wouldn't got to what I got to with the I'm a Scientist, get me out of it. Because I think that's where there's a big part, because you need the encouragement, you know, when you're starting off something, you know. At the same time, like, you know, I'm happy to change my mind. So when I saw your stuff, I thought to myself, this looks a bit weird. But I'm happy to humble myself to say, maybe I got this wrong. Maybe I'll look at it again. Maybe I was harsh. I was harsh. It's admitting, no, I should not have done that. You know, that kind of thing. And admitting that to yourself rather than, oh, yes, Harvey, I thought you were like, I think you were, you know, you were off. You're way off the mark when you were doing it, but it's admitting it to yourself what you've done, which is the most important step in your own reconciliation with anything that that you don't disagree with, and that can stop your progress. So for me, it was admitting that to say, you know, do it yourself and find out what it's like. If I had not done that process, thinking, I'm a scientist, get me out of here, I would have been out the window. Yeah. I would never got there in the first place. I would never applied. Let alone do it.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating to hear your explanation of being involved in that process and what it did for you. Now, what I've found really interesting is what you said about, and I know this of you as well, because we've been friends for a long time, that you're not naturally someone who is inclined to overly celebrate their own successes. And it was nice for you just to hear you say and admit that you're not that person. So I'd be interested to know, when you have achievements like this, such as winning the competition of I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here, while you don't celebrate your successes at any level, do you find that it gives you motivation to carry on and keep going along this journey of progression?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it comes from my mum. So my mum basically, you know, has instilled it in for me. This is not a game. This game is not a life, you know. So this life is not a game, and she instilled into us from a young age about hard work. I mean, and I've talked about this in my previous podcast with you, I remember, about, you know, the early influences, about it's not something that, you know, you shouldn't just clap yourself, what you're doing, move on to the next thing. because there's still things out there to be done. As long as you're behaving within the most important thing you should be concerned yourself is about your conduct and learning. Like, of course, you know, I've made mistakes along the way, and still will do, of course. And I'm trying to learn from each mistake by listening, but also trusting people. Trust is a big thing. Trusting yourself to celebrate. But I think, recognize or celebrating is not an easy thing to do. And I think it's important for others to celebrate you. And I think that was important. So people took me, don't get me wrong, people took me out. People basically, like, I remember my mate before the, during the ride time, he said, you need to reward yourself. We're going to go around Europe. You're coming with me. You know, basically, like, that's the kind of, like, you know, support that was. So at the moment, I said, no, I can't do it. I can't, you know, do it because I haven't got time. I get distracted. He goes, no, take your laptop with you. You can do it. I'll give you the time. I'll make sure no one disturbs you. And it's that level of, like, someone needs to celebrate you in that way, to recognize your hard work. And by sitting there, obviously looking at the mountains and, you know, going through all these countries, doing the PhD in the back of a car and doing it on the laptop, it was, a very rewarding experience. It's something that sticks with me, you see? So I think you need to have good people around you and who will basically help you and not hinder you. That's important. Who would empower you, encourage you, because that's part of the celebration. Then it's not just about sticking a birthday cake and blowing candles out. Celebration comes in different forms. That's one thing I realized, and I think that's an important part. And if you don't know how to celebrate, goodness me, you've got Google, right? Plenty of blogs, plenty of read a book. Goodness, I just thought to myself, like, if you don't know how to do something, right, and you've done everything else, I'm like, no, that's no excuse. That's just you choosing not to be supportive. And what that means is that when you're trying to celebrate, you have to do it in, you can do it different ways. And I had to learn about myself. I'm like, okay, if you can't celebrate me, why should you? Of course, everyone has a choice, right? No one has a right over each other. But I learned how to celebrate myself, or I'm learning too. You know, I think I say that to all the listeners. I'm like, look, it doesn't matter who can't celebrate with you and all of this stuff, right? They should, you know, it'd be nice. But if they don't, you must celebrate yourself. And that's what I'm, I think, recognizing within myself. Like, I'm celebrating myself, being kind to myself in that sense. You know, and that's from a faith perspective, but even from a moral perspective, that we do have responsibility. Like, yeah, it doesn't matter if no one turns up to your thing. It's the ones who do matter. Focus on the present, I say. So it's a lot of mindfulness here. And, you know, wish well on everybody else, of course, but most importantly, wish well on yourself. And if we do this, then we create a sustainable way of, like, reaching our full potential without sabotaging or hindering our own progress.
Yeah, very thought-provoking. Thank you so much for sharing that. It was really interesting how you described that. And yeah, as you said, we're all kind of on this journey, right, of self-discovery. We're trying to figure out ourselves, and we're using all of these avenues on this planet to kind of figure out who we are. And you seem to be doing that really well. In many forms. So I wish you all the best with that. And I'm sure you're going to go from strength to strength with everything. Now, we've talked a lot about your work professionally. So I just want to switch gears again and talk about something in your personal life. Now, about a year ago, I remember having a guest on the show, Brian Segay, his name was. And we were having a conversation about life, about personal development. And I remember we touched on a subject to do with friends and our inner circle. And I shared with them at the time that I had not too long ago renegotiated my inner circle, meaning I had drastically reduced my inner circle. So these being my closest friends. So at the time I had reduced them from 4 to 5 to 1. And I found that to be quite a profound shift in my personal life. And in fact, it allowed me to free up a lot of space in my mind to do the things I wanted to do. Now, the reason I'm mentioning that is because I know you've gone through something very similar very recently. So if you're comfortable doing so, I'd love for you to share your experience of this process and how reducing your own circle of friends, meaning the number of friends in your circle, how that's helped you progress in the last few years.
I think, you know, for the first thing I'll probably point out, it's always evolving, right? I think when you're going through life, lots of people are coming in and out. And obviously when you lose or when you gain, there's different arousal, let's just say, that can happen, right? We can be in an aroused state, you know, we can be excited, we can be sad, we can be angry, we can be confused. So I think it's about recognizing, like, that will have a natural impact on the way you think and the way you behave. But I think over time, I've always been open-minded about how friendships been work and supporting people in different ways. The support system is still the same. Sometimes it can be because, you know, you're limited because other people might want all your resources because, you know, they're in need, and that's fine because you have to support that person. And one friend might not need as much. So I found that basically I was switching a lot of resources around the time around different people in different stages of their life, right? So one person might go very quiet, okay, doesn't need much support at the moment, but another person do, so I'll switch and give my time and attention there. So I found that basically being flexible, that's what really helped me. But I remember, like, at the time when I was finishing the PhD, my resources had basically been, like, almost, like, you know, depleted because my energy levels were so low because of the pandemic, I think, happened at the same time. But more, and at the same time, 6 days before, or a few days before, I don't know, 6 days, but less than a week, my exam got cancelled for the PhD. By that point, I was on my knees. I was very, very, and I think the world was in a very, like, uncertain place. People didn't know what was going on. We didn't know if we were working from home. We thought it'd be over in 2 weeks, we can go back. I remember they said it'll be over by, you know, by the summer. Then they said August, they said October. I remember all of that anxiety and running the charity, responsibilities about what message do we communicate? How do we restructure it in a way that people get support? We lost a lot of people. Some of volunteers passed away. so there was a lot of things happening in that brief period. There was a massive storm, if you like. And I think having supportive people were very, you know, like running thin on ice, right? That's the best way to frame it in that sense. But hey, I was quite understanding. Maybe it was all this stuff. But actually, I make no excuses now. And I make no excuses then, and I never made no excuses when I was younger about quality standards. You know, like, if you've done something, then there's a way to go about to reconcile. Like, it's not about the action, it's about the reaction. Okay. And I've always been open-minded about solutions. But at the same time, you know, by speaking to lots of different people, you know, getting their perspectives and getting help. Getting help was important. So lucky I had people around me, you know, both personally and professionally, right, to deal with the healing mechanisms that came with, you know, whatever happened in that moment. But what it taught me was, like, it's okay, it happens. This is part of life. And if there's a situation, then you have to react to it. You know, sometimes you can't control everything. But for me, it was important of, like, you know, if people have a certain relationship with you, it's a two-way process, right? You know, and I realized that actually, you know, I have to respect that. So if people decided to walk away and don't want to engage in the most open and genuine way, that's fine. Like, you have to accept it. You know, why should they? You know, like, you should get that expectation out of your head that they need to be somehow, you know, be the way you want them to be. No, like, it's free choice. And vice versa, like, you know, I think I had to take my responsibility of my own. But actually, yeah, it is a two-way two-way street, this thing. And but people decide to walk away, you know, it's about respecting that. People don't want to be there, that's fine. And I say that to your listeners, like, if people don't want to be there for you, no matter what you've, you know, like you've done and all this stuff, that's okay. Like, don't be sad, just accept, you know, this is, and then move forward. But, you know, for me, it's all about not having, what's the word, you know, any sort of like regret or anger, or that's an important part. So it's, for me, I would never going to react. It's not something I would do, because I've never done that anyway, being that way, because I think it just fuels the fire. And you have to be thinking about yourself here, like, actually, what is best for everybody? What's best for you, most importantly? Yeah, I'm not going to feel the fire, because at the end of the day, but if people decide to cope in a different way or react in a different way, then that's their choice. Again, you can't really say anything about that. That's a reflection on them. But I think then you concentrate on the ones who are there, and the ones who basically you know, your key supporters, if you like, the people who empower you, like your family, for example. So I think that was a big learning experience, both in the profession, personally in the profession. It had me understand about, you know, the impact when you have like big life events. I mean, for me, and maybe other people will say this, that's not a big life moment. For me, it was the biggest life moment, because I was building up to this for so many years, quietly working in the background, and quite rightly so, because I had lots of responsibilities. And so I was practically on my knees, like I said at the beginning of this question, of this answer. I was on my knees trying to get over that finish line, because it takes a piece out of you, like pushing you all the way, literally. And you are under constant, obviously constructive criticism about your work, about your approach of the course of your PhD, for example, but also like you're criticizing yourself. So for others, people to do that, I think to myself, okay, are you adding value or are you adding noise? You know, for me, that's an important part now. I thought to myself, that's the more important thing. Because you wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't do that, if you know what I mean. Or maybe I have, I don't know. And maybe it's something that I've become more self-conscious of. I'm like, I'm not going to do that because I know what it's like. I like to think that I haven't, not intentionally to do that. I don't think people are intentionally to hurt people. But there's consequences of your actions. If you think about like manslaughter, you know, you might not want to kill anybody, might not intended, but you still shot someone and you've killed that person. You got to take responsibility. That's accountability. That's what we say as like civilized people. So I think people have to come to terms with what they did in that sense. They have to reconcile. But I don't think it's anything to do with me. It's just like I reconciled with what I did and, you know, how I reacted. And I realized that it's not my responsibility to even think about, you know, others. I think Everyone has an individual choice about how they live their own lives and the way they make their own decisions. And, you know, with the people around me, about this, you know, you said about the circle, it's varied, you know. So it might be like in different in numbers, whatever, but it's varied. So people come and get advice, as they do, as they've always done. People share. I get advice, you know. I have lots of mentors, I have lots of psychologists, I have a lot of therapists around me. I have different family members who make a contribution. You know, I've got nephews and nieces who are an important part of my life, you know. So I think there's going to be always that evolving part. And I'm interested to know who else would come. But I know that obviously, as we interact as humans, especially in my circle, other people have benefited, you know, have gained. And that's a good thing. That's a healthy thing. So just because I brought one person into the circle and or I've been introduced to another person, I've benefited or another person's benefited. So it's a part of the ever-evolving sort of like advantages that come. And it should do. The whole point of interaction is we create this energy to do good things, constructive things, positive things.
Yeah.
That answers your question.
No, it does. You went above and beyond actually to answer that question. And I find it a fascinating subject. As I said, it's something that I went through myself a few years ago, and I found it to be extremely beneficial. And I think it's actually quite underrated, the idea of really delving deep and looking into your inner circle to ask those somewhat difficult questions, which is, are the people in my circle providing value to me? And if they're not, it can often be difficult to renegotiate your friend circle. But I think in order to progress in life, in order to grow, you have to change that circle if the people in it are not giving you value. And yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that, because I know it's quite personal to you. It was a personal experience. But I think by you sharing that, there are many lessons in what you said. So thank you for that. Now, I want to go back to something that we mentioned, I believe, at the beginning of our conversation, which was your new role at the University of Sunderland. Now, in order to take up that role, you had to make a major life change, which was uprooting from your hometown in Luton in Bedfordshire, which is south of the UK, and moving up north to the north of the United Kingdom. And it's a long way away from what you were used to. So what I wanted to ask was, why did you decide to uproot? I know it was for the job, but were there any other reasons why you wanted to move to completely change your location? And secondly, I wanted to ask, have you found any challenges along the way when it came to uprooting yourself completely?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, I was thinking to myself, okay, is this the right thing? I mean, all those thoughts go through your head, and I think about, you know, what I said to you in the earlier of the conversation around, you know, life changes. I've always been exposed to that and to make the choice. When I think about like being in a position of like caring for the family from a young age, and now obviously if people have grown up, we've got the support mechanisms in place, and you know, we bought the family home, and again, something discussed in the last podcast, it felt like the natural thing to do. Like, we just felt like, yeah, it's the good time to do it, because I've achieved all my goals in terms of helping the family, achieving in terms of like the qualifications I've got to put in the infrastructure to change the town's strategy on mental health, for example. So it's both personally and professionally, I've achieved what I wanted to achieve. And it was interesting to see these dynamics happen, you know, change over time as a natural thing, perhaps. Maybe the COVID-19 made me realize, actually, we can still be in contact because we've got this whole online mechanism. You know, it's a problem. It's how we envision it in our head. We think to ourselves, we have to live within certain parameters. But I just thought to myself, if we have the support systems in place, it should be fine. And we're growing up, so we're moving on to the next part of our life. I'm like, okay. And then I think to myself, like, the opportunity came along, like, should really take it, because you don't know if an opportunity will come again. And it's not just a job. This is basically where they believe in your approach to things. And then making the decision to actually to come up here from the north and the south has an impact, both, I think, in a positive way. So, for example, it's improved the relationship that me and my mum got. So before, you know, we would not be that, it'd be very much transactional, you know, relationship, yes and no. Do you want this? Do you want that? Okay, you have to do medication and things like that. But now when we have that, I realized that my mom knows that she can't beat this thing. And, you know, she knows that I know she can't beat it, because it's very hard. Before, I would be very, not judgmental, but I want her to beat it. You know, trying to like, you can do this, you can do that, that pressure, that expectation. And she might feel guilty of like letting me down, whatever, I don't know. But at the same time, she knows that I know that it's okay if she can't beat it. You know, I'll still be here with you in spirit, that kind of thing. And, you know, now when I leave home, and when I come back and visit, for example, see the family. So the only time I come back is to see the family now. Well, unless I've got charity meetings, face-to-face that I have to have. So the only time I come back is the family, and you know, every time I leave or every time I go in, I basically you know, hug my mum. And that never used to happen before, right? And my mum expects it. And it's a different type of hug. But when I leave, I hug her before I leave, like after a few days if I stay there, right? And my mum knows, and she breaks down, kind of like breaks down when I basically leaving. You know, she's anticipating. I think she's, I noticed that the hug reaching and the hug leaving is too different. And being a psychologist, you know, quite observant about these things, right? Especially when it comes to your own parents. And I do that to my own siblings now. I never did that before, you know? And so I think it's improved, like the interaction and the affection, if you like, between the siblings. And I think it's allowed people to take on, for me to basically pass on that equal sort of like pressure. Everyone had responsibility, didn't you? Everyone did their own thing. Everyone mucked in, like when we were younger. But in terms of the burden and the top pressure on me to be the one that has to come up with the answers, is kind of like now equally being shared. And I think that's been a big part of the growth, because I think it's important for my own, like, you know, siblings to, for their own families, like when they grow and develop, they need to be exposed to that sort of experience. So I think it's good. Obviously, my, you know, like recent life change, my brother got married. So if I imagine that if I didn't make that move, maybe that wouldn't have happened. So I think like you have to understand there's sometimes there's bigger things at play. And again, trusting the journey. And I remember like driving into the Upper North, I was driving, I thought to myself, you know what I did before I forget the story is I drove from it was a hot day, right? I went to meet the team. And I was like gonna move in. So I thought to myself, I'm going to do roof down in the convertible and just driving in because a hot day was the sun. And I drove all the way from Luton up to the north from the south with the roof down, entering the north with the hood down. I think that was a very symbolic moment for me to say this is a new, you know, new chapter. It's another chapter. It's not like something you're doing something different. It's the same thing when you're done from when you left school to coming into, you know, apprenticeship, to go to university, to go to buy a house, and it's a new beginning in different, and you're going to meet different people, and people can be still in touch, just to make that point about, you know, what you said about, you know, friends and stuff. You know, the door is always open. It just means that the conditions might not be the same because things have changed. The door is always open. You know, I'm a very, you know, open human being. It just means things are might be a bit different, but that's natural because of, and I think being in the north has allowed me to reflect, because you're in the north, right? And it's funny that we've done the podcast in London, I remember.
Yeah, the last time we did the show, yeah, you're right. It was in London. I was in London. You were also down south. It's quite an interesting point you've raised, actually. Yeah, it's a lot's happened since then. I'm in the north as well. I think it's about, 3 hours between us? So I'm in Liverpool, you're in Sunderland. It's about 3 hours, roughly, 3.5 hours. The North is it's a completely different vibe. But I like the vibe. People are more friendlier here. And there's more of a relaxed atmosphere, I feel, in the North, especially in Liverpool. I wonder if you feel the same where you are in Sunderland. Did you notice a significant difference in the vibe between South and North when you first moved?
Yeah, I remember like, it's interesting because I remember when I went, finished work, because like, you know, where I live is live by the coast, right? And, you know, trying to make the most out of it because you don't know, you know, if you'll be this forever kind of thing, right? Live by the coast. And I remember driving back to home from work. And there's a coastal route, and on the way you see the sea, the Northeast Sea. And I thought to myself, like, what the hell is this? Like, this is quite cool. And I went to get some fish, and I thought to myself, okay, still winter park up. I thought, okay, still light. Where can I go? Let me go and get some fish and chips. And the fish and chips were literally. And I thought to myself, like, when I went to buy the fish and chips, I come outside, and I'm like, I've got this fish and chips in the box, right? I look around. I think to myself, what am I doing here? And I look around, there's the sea. That's what life is. There's the sea in front of you. You know, I hope that, like I said, these moments might not last forever, but I make the most of it. And I think that's what I've always done. I look around, I just looked up, right? Because the fish and chip place is basically opposite the sea. It overlooks the sea. It's like a goldfish restaurant. And it was not that busy. I was the only person in there. And I thought to myself, like, I look up and there's the sea, just like the North East Sea. There's me and fish and chips going home. From all those little, you know, moments that I had. That was a big moment of like, you know, like I'm here now. And that's where my work is. That's where I need to do the work on.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess because once you'd made that decision to move, you got the job, obviously you had to move. There isn't much time in those type of situations to really sit down by yourself and contemplate as to what's actually happening. Because you're making preparations to move, and you make the move, you pack the car, you drive to your new home, and before you know it, you know, you're starting your new job. So
I should point out that with that question that you're on, that you're going to answer about friendliness. I mean, people, you know, seem to know my orders right before I get there, but they see me, I think, from a distance, whatever, and when I walk into the shop, if the order's there, the cup of tea, the fish and chips, they know the name. And I only realized when I went to the counter, they presented the stuff with me, right? And they asked for the money, and they were looking at me. I was like, I didn't even say anything, right? I was looking back as if like, this is for someone else. They said, no, this is for you. I was still ordering, I'm still making my order. They said, no, this is yours. And we got a bit confused. They said, then I realized, okay, this person must have just like, she was like, yeah, I know what you're going to have. I know what you're going to order. I know what time you're going to come in. And it's that basically level of like, friendliness, which I noticed, like, you know, I found that they're very customer focused.
Yeah.
Interaction. I don't know if you found that, but, you know, when they go in, they're interested in having a bit of like.
Yeah, people up north, from my experience as well, they're certainly more inclined towards conversation. Even if it's not lengthy conversation, just a simple hello or thank you. Actually, the biggest thing I've noticed here in Liverpool, I'm not sure if you notice this where you are, is saying sorry. For example, if someone's got in your way or they've accidentally, I don't know, closed the door in front of you without knowing you're behind them, you know, just simple things like that. Or if you're going into a shop, you know, sometimes you have the barriers where you just have to push open if they've let that close behind them without knowing you're there. They'll say sorry for simple things that you normally wouldn't expect a sorry for. And this happened a few days ago, actually. I was in the local supermarket and I was trying to get to the freezer section, and there was a woman standing in the way, which meant that I couldn't open the actual freezer section. And she just looked behind and just apologized profusely. And I was thinking in my mind, there wasn't a need to do that. But as you said, I think it's just in the nature of people up north. They are that way inclined. So being around these people, as you said, it's quite a nice experience, as they're very friendly. So, you know, I'm glad that you're enjoying your experience up north, and you're going from strength to strength in your new environment, keeping busy with everything that you're doing. Before we wrap up, I just wanted to give the opportunity to mention anything that you'd like to mention, perhaps something that I haven't asked in my questions that you wanted to share. And then after that, we'll give everyone a reminder of how they can find out more about your work.
Yeah, so I would say, thanks so much for having me on. I think back to our conversation 4 years ago, roughly about the same time in the summertime, I think, and like what's happened. Maybe I need to appreciate that a bit more about the journey I've been on. So thank you for so much for, complimenting me and my achievements. And, you know, I think one day I'll probably appreciate it. But thank you again for like, you know, giving me the inspiration to, be different. It's okay to be different, to do something different. That's important. To try something different. You know, I know you're going through some sort of different, like, you know, different, exploring different journeys and trying to discover who you are. And I think that's important for me because I'm still on that journey. I haven't found what I'm looking for yet. And I think I look back on teaching in psychology, like one of the things that shocked me the most in terms of like lecturing in psychology, being a lecturer, because it, you know, we have a certain vision, a way something should be or a person should be. And that is all wrong. This is misleading. This is what can cause problems. And everyone, and so if you don't have that perception of like, if you do have a perception and that you need to be a certain way or you need to do a certain way or a certain thing is the only way, this is destructive. Run away from this thinking immediately if anyone's listening. Run away from it. It's important to be your authentic individual self. You don't need to imitate and copy others. And the only reason why I say this is because I used to think this about lecturers, right? Lecturers are portrayed in a certain way, okay? They have a certain look about them, for example. They speak a certain way. And that's because we are conditioned over time, because what we see in the media and films and things that we see and we heard about, that, you know, all lecturers have to be a certain way. And then I think about the university who've taken me on and how they've accepted me. They've not asked me to change anything about me. So I teach with my cap on. I thought to myself, is that even allowed? And I remember my senior management team said, it's not about how you look like. It's about what contribution you're making. That's the bit, that's the most important thing you can ever do to students and in teaching and learning. And for me, I think to myself, I look around that team and they are all different in their appearance, but their conduct, their behavior, the professionalism is like second to none. And that reinforced me to say it's important to be yourself. So those people who are listening to the podcast, do not imitate, copy others. Yeah, you can take tips and passion and things like, of course, Marx, you need to do that. But I think it's important to not to abandon your core self. You know, we are, I mean, I've like I said, I've read so many blogs and, you know, read so many articles and journals. And one thing that seems to be destructive is that we want people to be a certain way. This type of thinking is destructive. Run away from it. Encourage yourself and others to be their individual self. Do not laugh at others. Do not mock each other's progress. You can do that when you're younger, right? I get it, right? But when you become an adult, you are hurting yourself. You are hurting your own journey. You are sabotaging yourself. You're psychologically self-harming. You know, you are hindering your own progress. Not in terms of progress of how much materialism you can keep. And there's one thing that you maybe you want to be interested in, you know, you as a host of it, looking into the concept of materialism and dualism. There's two ways of living your life, dualism and materialism. People collect, so it's all about materials, and dualism is about connecting both mind and body, about how we collect experiences about the environment. So I think the most important thing I want to say to people is, before I go, is be your authentic self. Don't follow my journey, follow your own. Get inspiration from others, of course, but you're the inspiration, like, within you. And the most important thing that I think is effective, like what I find helpful, is what would you say to your 10-year-old self, your 12-year-old self, your 15, you know, look back at a younger self and say, what would you say to that person, to your younger self? What words would you give them? You know, that's, for me, like, it's been most helpful. So I would tell my younger self, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. Like, don't worry about the future, mate. Future's going to work out. It's cool. You'll be a psychologist. You'll be whatever. I'm a scientist. Get me out of here. You know what I mean? You'll be a founder. No problem, man. But focus and enjoy exactly what you're doing. Don't worry about the future such. Just focus on this point in your life. You'll be okay. I'm telling you because I can see it. I'm already here and I can see your life. If you're moving in this path, I can see it because I know what you're going to achieve. So do not abandon your path. And do not be afraid to make mistakes. Don't judge yourself. Don't be harsh on yourself. Reward yourself. Celebrate yourself. No one's there to celebrate you. It's cool. Celebrate with people who are. But you keep going. Like, you'll be fine. That's the bit that I want to say to people. What advice would you give to yourself?
Yeah. Well, Dr. Jalal, that advice was superb. It's very wise words. And it got me thinking a lot as well about my own approach to the stuff that I do. So thank you for triggering that in me. And I'm sure a lot of people who are watching and listening as well. Guys, you have been watching the Sabir Bharti Show. I hope you've enjoyed this very special episode with our very special guest, Dr. Jalal. Remember, if you want to find out more about Dr. Jalal's work, you can do so by visiting his website, which is drjalal.com. That's spelled drjalel.com. Please also go check him out on his Twitter and Instagram using his handle at Dr. Jalal, spelled exactly the same way. So that's drjalel at Dr. Jalal on Twitter and Instagram. And of course, just a reminder as well about his YouTube channel. He is creating very interesting videos all to do with psychology, helping you access the nuances behind psychology through his YouTube channel. Simply type in Dr. Jalal on YouTube and you'll come across his videos. And last but not least, of course, his fabulous podcast, which is Psychology Cast. Again, you can search for that, I believe, on YouTube, and it's also widely available on many podcast platforms. Thank you once again, Dr. Jalal, for being on the show. It's been an absolute honor and pleasure to have you on. I wish you all the best. And thank you, viewers and listeners, for tuning into this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, take care of yourself. Have a blessed day. Take care. Bye-bye.